Perhaps you have heard of these accounts where maybe it's a wife whose husband, and this is a horrible thought, is stuck underneath a vehicle or something, and then she seems to be infused with this strength necessary to lift that vehicle up off of her husband on that occasion. And we read and we hear, and perhaps you've even experienced that sudden surge of strength or just what you needed to thwart some crisis. What's interesting, though, is not only can you read and even learn about things that happen like this, but sometimes it's those same people that'll collapse under the shock of what's happened. And there's a spiritual application here, a counterpart. Sometimes in our lives we experience this sudden tragedy, and it seems that we have the strength that we need to endure that tragedy, only to be followed by some very difficult days that are behind it. And there's a difference. It's one thing to experience that tragedy and to make it through it, but then it's quite another for that misery that can often follow for days, weeks, or even months. And that's a heavy way to introduce this lesson, but I want us to see that may be just what's happening in the book of Job. In Job chapter 1, he's received one set of bad news after the other, culminating in the loss of all 10 of his children. And then we know what's going on behind the scenes because we have the record here. We know that God has pointed out Job as a model of faithfulness to Satan himself. And Satan says, well, it's no wonder that he serves you. You've built a hedge around him. You take away some of his blessings and he'll curse you to your face. So God allows Satan to take those things from him. But at the end of Job chapter 1, we find these words. Then Job arose, tore his robe, shaved his head, and fell to the ground and worshipped. And he said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." It's as if, based upon his faith, he has had that strength to still stand with his faith intact. He's received this devastating news, but he's been able to make it through that day. And then in chapter 2, we find that Satan is not through. God's still holding up Job. "Have you considered my servant Job? There's no one like him. He's a man of faith." And Satan says, "Yes, but if you take away his health, he'll curse you to your face." So God allows Satan to inflict that terrible disease on him that has boils all over him. But how does he end that? Job 2, verse 10. When Job's wife, seems to me, is trying to just help him get put out of his misery, says, "Why don't you just curse God and die?" And Job says, "You speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God, and shall we not accept adversity? In all this, Job did not sin with his lips." So again, a severe test. But Job has passed the test. He's kept his faith intact. But watch this. Job's suffering doesn't end at the end of chapter 2. In fact, as we read through Job 3 and following, we see Job is still struggling. I'm afraid I've even mentally put a divider between Job 2 and chapter 3 and following. But what I've been reminded is Job's suffering didn't end there. Obviously, there was the emotional suffering of all these terrible losses. But there's also the physical suffering. Apparently, God doesn't take away that disease. He's continuing to be just absolutely miserable. And there's several statements that we'll find in the book of Job that describe his suffering, not only emotionally, but physically as well. Job's faith and his reverence were not rewarded by a quick healing of his disease and an immediate restoration of all the things that he's lost. In fact, Job 7, verse 2, We find these words from Job: like a servant who earnestly desires the shade, and like a hired man who eagerly looks for his wages, so I have been allotted months of futility, or nights of misery have been assigned to me. Job's still struggling. He's miserable. All this turmoil in his life, and he's struggling here. And the question looms: why? Had not Job shown God that God was his most precious treasure, and God's honor had been upheld by Job? Why doesn't God immediately restore his fortunes? Does he have to wait till chapter 42 to see this happy ending? Well, the lesson is that Job had to learn more about suffering and about God, just as we must learn. So let's consider for a few moments, and I hope it'll have a bright spot at the end, but let's consider Job's misery for a moment. We'll begin in chapter 2, the end of chapter 2. When Job's three friends heard of all this adversity that had come upon him, each one came from his own place: Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, Zophar the Naamathite. For they had made an appointment together to come and mourn with him and to comfort him. And when they raised their eyes from afar and did not recognize him, they lifted their voices and wept. Each one tore his robe and sprinkled dust on his head toward heaven. So they sat down with him on the ground 7 days and 7 nights, and no one spoke a word to him, for they saw that his grief was very great. That's the end of chapter 2. What follows are three cycles of speeches. And I'm going to show you a chart of those speeches. And I'm also going to ask you to relax. I'm not going to try to cover all three cycles of those speeches. I will take a look at the first three cycles, but you'll see Eliphaz speaks first, Job answers. And then Bildad speaks up, and then Job answers. Zophar then speaks, and Job answers. And there's these three cycles of these speeches. But our question that I want us to explore tonight is this: what does the author of this book want us to learn from the speeches of Job's three friends and from Job's responses to them as he endures month after month of misery? Let's begin with the first cycle of speeches that are prompted by Job's outburst. Look at Job chapter 3 with me, the opening verses. And it tells us Job's mindset now. He's been through that day of terrible loss in his life. He's been through that day when that disease comes upon him that we read about in Job chapter 2. He's still suffering from those things in his life. How does he feel about it? Job 3, verse 1. After this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. He said, "May the day of my birth perish, and the night it was said a boy is born." Verse 9, "May its morning stars become dark. May it wait for daylight in vain and not see the first rays of dawn. For it did not shut the doors of the womb on me to hide trouble from my eyes. Why did I not perish at birth and die as I came from the womb?" You tell me, how does Job feel? His suffering is so intense, he's wishing he had never been born. Isn't that a summation of what he's saying here? He cannot see any reason for why he should have ever been given life, or why his life should be preserved, because he's going through so much misery here. In fact, his speech ends with these words. Verse 26, "I have no peace, no quietness. I have no rest, but only turmoil." And I suspect, based upon what his three friends say, that they're sitting here and they're listening to him, and he's saying some challenging things, and they just have to speak. And Eliphaz breaks in first. Perhaps he's the oldest of the three friends. But he will identify a principle that he and the other two friends are going to repeat. They're going to try to answer Job. Job doesn't understand why is he suffering so. And they've got an explanation. We'll see Eliphaz, his theological principle, stated in verses 7 and 8 of chapter 4. Listen to it. "Consider now," Eliphaz is saying to Job, Who, being innocent, has ever perished? Where were the upright ever destroyed? As I have observed, those who plow evil and those who sow trouble reap it. What's the implication? What's Eliphaz saying? Job, you must have been plowing evil and sowing trouble, and now you're reaping what you have sown. You must have done something terrible for God to be punishing you like this. That's the explanation that Eliphaz gives here. He will go on to say that he acknowledges that all men are sinners. He will also admit that some suffering is the loving chastening or the loving discipline of God. But here's what Eliphaz, this is his counsel to Job. Verse 8 of Job chapter 5. If it were I would appeal to God. I would lay my cause before him. The lowly he sets on high, and those who mourn are lifted to safety. He's telling Job, basically, Job, you haven't really sought God the way you should. So you need to come clean before God. You need to lay it out before God. And he's assuring him that God will raise him back up. He goes on in chapter 5, verses 18 and 19. Blessed is the man whom God corrects. So do not despise the discipline of the Almighty. For he wounds, but he also binds up. He injures, but his hands also heal. But Job, he doesn't even have to read between the lines. He knows exactly what Eliphaz is saying. Eliphaz is telling him, God is correcting you, Job. You've done something, you deserve to be punished. So he's punished you. So you need to repent, and he'll restore you. Well, Job responds. He protests, affirming his innocence. Job believes that Eliphaz's explanation is too simple. It doesn't answer the hard questions, such as, why do some suffer in an extraordinary way even though they haven't sinned in an extraordinary way? And the other part of that is, it doesn't answer why some prosper in an extraordinary way even though they are extraordinary sinners. He's using Eliphaz's principle here that God punishes the wicked, he rewards the righteous, and he's saying that doesn't always fit reality. So Job protests his innocence in chapter 6, verses 8 through 10. Oh, that I might have my request, that God would grant what I hope for, that God would be willing to crush me, to let loose his hand and cut me off. Then I would still have this consolation, my joy and unrelenting pain, that I had not denied the words of the Holy One. He's saying, I wish God would just end my life. And if so, then I could hang on to this truth that I've not denied him. I've not denied him. So he turns the table back on Eliphaz, chapter 6, verse 24. Teach me and I'll be quiet. Show me where I have been wrong. Prove to me, he's saying, show me what I've done to deserve this punishment from God, and I'll be silent. Job 7, verse 11, therefore I will not keep silent, Job says. I will speak out in the anguish of my spirit. I will complain in the bitterness of my soul. And Bildad speaks next. And I imagine he's been biting his tongue, and finally he just erupts. And he follows the same line of reasoning as Eliphaz, but yet he's much harsher. He vigorously insists on Eliphaz's principle of justice, even applying it to Job's children. And folks, I find this heartless and brutal. Look with me, chapter 8. Then Bildad the Shuhite replied, how long will you say such things? Your words are a blustering wind. Does God pervert justice? Does the Almighty pervert what is right? Notice this. When your children sinned against him, he gave them over to the penalty of their sin. Do you see what he's saying? Your children died because they had sinned against God. Don't you know that just cuts Job to the core? He's speaking where God has not spoken. And he's saying, it's the same with you, Job. You're suffering because of some terrible sins that you've committed. And so his admonishment in chapter 8, verses 5 and 6, if you will look to God and plead with the Almighty, if you are pure and upright, even now he will rouse himself on your behalf and restore you to your rightful place. Repent, Job. Repent, and God will restore you. Job, however, doesn't surrender. He's very familiar with this theological principle they're sharing of the justice of God. He rewards the righteous and punishes the wicked. But he's saying it doesn't fit. It's utterly out of sync with the way things are. And so Job 10, verses 1 through 3, he still avows that he is innocent of such terrible sins. I loathe my very life, he says. Therefore, I will give free rein to my complaint and speak out in the bitterness of my soul. I will say to God, do not condemn me, but tell me what charges you have against me. Does it please you to oppress me, to spurn the work of your hands while you smile on the schemes of the wicked? And he's asking God, show me, God, what have I done? What have I done to deserve this? Zophar has also been biting his tongue, I'm sure. And now he erupts. He's even more harsh yet than the other two friends. He rebukes Job for claiming to be innocent. And he tells him again, you need to put away your sin. Job 11, verse 13. If you devote your heart to him and stretch out your hands to him, if you put away the sin that is in your hand and allow no evil to dwell in your tent, then you will lift up your face without shame. You will stand firm and without fear. I think we can summarize what those three friends are saying by saying that according to his friends, Job is suffering because he refuses to put iniquity far from him. Job is suffering because there's some terrible sin in his life. Well, chapters 12 through 14, to round out that first cycle of speeches, Job responds with some sarcasm. He says things like, your maxims, your sayings are like proverbs of ashes. In other words, they don't do anything for him. They're irritating. Job goes on to say that he longs to argue his case with God, because he knows that God is just, but he also believes he is innocent. Look at chapter 13, verses 3 and 4. I desire to speak to the Almighty, Job says, and to argue my case with God. You, however, speaking of his friends, smear me with lies. You are worthless physicians, all of you. What you're saying isn't helping at all. It doesn't fit. You're worthless physicians. In fact, wouldn't you agree that part of Job's misery here is because of the explanations that his friends are offering him? They're only making it worse for him. And the cycles of conversation that continue really raise no new arguments. They just show that these three friends are becoming more and more harsh and less credible in the face of Job's integrity and his realism. Eliphaz keeps saying it's the wicked man that writhes in pain. Bildad echoes, it's the light of the wicked that is put out. Zophar says the joy of the wicked is short. I'm going to jump all the way to the end of Eliphaz's third speech. It's chapter 22, and I want you to see how far Eliphaz has gone. Job 22, beginning with verse 5. He's saying to Job, is not your wickedness great? Are not your sins endless? You demanded security from your brothers for no reason. You stripped men of their clothing, leaving them naked. You gave no water to the weary, and you withheld food from the hungry. Though you were a powerful man owning land, an honored man living on it, and you sent widows away empty-handed and broke the strength of the fatherless. That is why snares are all around you, why sudden peril terrifies you. And the question is, did Job really do those things? That doesn't fit the description that God gives of Job. Here's what I believe Eliphaz is doing. He's grasping at straws. You must have done something, Job. So it must have been things like this, things where you saw the needy and you didn't help. And so you're just full of wickedness, Job, and your suffering is evidence of that. By the way, in that third cycle of speeches, Bildad follows, and he makes his last speech that only comprises six verses, and he speaks about the general sinfulness of mankind. And I noticed on the third cycle of speeches, Zophar doesn't even speak. Here's my theory. I think they run out of things to say. I think they see that Job isn't that bad character that they've described, but it doesn't fit their theology. It doesn't fit their understanding of, that God must be punishing Job, and so they run out of things to say. Their simple principle of justice has not been able to stand. Job is a good man, yet he suffers far worse than many very wicked people. But where I want to end tonight is with Job, looking at Job. I think as we read through these speeches, we see a change in Job. It began in chapter 3 where he's cursing the day of his birth. He's saying, it would be better for me if I had never been born. And he's even wishing that he had never been born. And there's this progression through. And he refers many times in his speeches to about dying and going to the grave and even longing for it. But there's a gradual change that we see in his speeches. From chapter 3, and I want to highlight a statement that he makes in chapter 19. He says this, I know that my Redeemer lives, and that in the end he will stand upon the earth. And after my skin has been destroyed, yet in my flesh I will see God. I myself will see him with my own eyes, I and not another. How my heart yearns within me. In the midst of that misery, there's still hope that he has. Job is still believing. I'm going to see God. I know that my Redeemer lives. I know I'm going to be vindicated. I know one day I'm going to understand. And it doesn't help him with all the questions that he has at that moment. But he's grown. I think he's seen through these weak explanations of his friends. And he recognizes, no, that's not what's going on here. I don't know what's happening, but I do know your explanations are false. They don't answer the questions. And it seems that by counteracting their arguments and their explanations, he's growing. He's growing in his faith. He hasn't lost hope. He continues to trust God, though he doesn't understand why things have happened to him. But he is confident of this. What's happening to him, the suffering that he's going through, is not for the reasons that his friends have proposed. I want to highlight one more statement in closing from Job. Did it just show you where he's still clinging to God? He's still wanting to trust God, even though he has so many questions. He makes this powerful statement, though he slay me, yet will I hope in him. Though he slay me, yet will I trust in him, some versions state it. He knows that God is his Redeemer. He knows that all he can do at this point is to continue to cling to God, to trust in him, despite these terrible explanations, despite the circumstances that he's going through. He knows that the only proper response that he can give is to continue to trust God. In the end, we know the rest of the story, he'll be blessed again. But he doesn't know that necessarily that that's coming. And it reminds us, how do you make it through the misery? How do you make it through the misery? The two awful days of Job 1 and 2, when we apply it to our own lives and we think back to those awful days when we receive some tragic news. And we've, by the grace of God, been able to endure those days. But then it's followed by the misery. It's followed by the empty chair. It's followed by the loss and the emotional grief and the questions that loom. How do you make it through the misery? What Job shows us is you continue to trust God. Through the questions, through the misery, you continue to hang on to Him. And when we read all the book, what we recognize is that when we choose to continue to cling to Him, even with our unanswered questions, that we will be rewarded in the end. That's to come. But we stop right there with this choice. And it is a choice. Job chose to refuse his friend's explanations and to cling to the hope that he had in God. That's a choice you and I need to make, to continue to trust God even when we don't have all the answers, knowing that He will reward us in the end. It may be tonight that you've been through some of the misery that we're speaking of, and it's caused you to question God and question why things are happening. May we make the choice that Job did, to continue to cling to Him. Though He slay me, yet I will trust Him. I will put my hope in Him. He's worthy of that trust. He is worthy of that hope. And it may be that you desire the prayers of the church for help through your time, or it may be that you desire tonight to obey the gospel of Jesus Christ, who is the hope that we have. If that be the case, if you're subject to the invitation, please come right now as we stand and sing.